Hello and welcome back to the Vacation Bible School Podcast. This is our second Q&A episode. We have made our way through three books of the Bible.
Wow, so much progress.
1/22nd of the way done. Hi, my name is Jason Kirk, joined as always by Emily. Hi, Emily, how you doing?
Hi, good, thanks. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. We are on the back porch. We have the Christmas lights out here in June, and we have the birds chirping. It's perfectly biblical setting. Yeah, there's birds in the Bible, so perfect. So before we dive into Numbers, now that we have finished Leviticus, we're going to break for a few questions sent in by listeners and so forth. This is your first time listening. This is our second Q&A episode, and the first one is probably a really good one to start the show with. So you might want to jump back to that one and then join us or, you know, do whatever you want. It's free will. Spoiler alert. But we have a few general questions we'd like to hit. As always, this is a podcast that is for people who believe, don't believe, used to believe, might believe again someday, any combination thereof. We would like to be welcoming.
Wondering what people who believe are thinking.
Yeah, that is that's probably the deepest question of all, the biggest question of all.
Yeah.
If you ask me, you know, is God real? I can probably fumble around for an answer. If you ask me, what do these believers think? Then it's, whew, good luck. I wanted to mention a funny thing that we encountered the other day. Emily, I learned that you, despite growing up Christian, remaining Christian to this day, had no familiarity with Jack Chick tracts.
None whatsoever.
This came up because you were telling a story about the Tooth Fairy.
Oh,
and
yes.
I mentioned
yes.
that there is a Jack Chick track about the Tooth Fairy, and you had no idea what I was talking
nope.
about. These are, of course, these mass-produced pamphlets that started in the 70s, and tens of millions of people read and shared these things. They're these little black and white cartoons. They're basically like the Onion cartoon, the Sickos, Haha Sickos, man. It's that. It's the predecessor of that type of thing with hell at stake, and like no irony at all. It's like God looking down as like Sickos, ha ha ha, yes, ha ha, right? These things are on every topic about Muslims and rabbis and atheists and gay people. Oh, they're all going to hell. They're all wrong. Right. There's one on every topic you can imagine. And there is one on how the Tooth Fairy, if you let your children believe in them, they will grow up and they will revile you for also teaching them that God is real. So they will believe in nothing. They will become serial killers. That's what happens in the Jack Chick track on the Tooth Fairy.
Is that a person's name? Is that how this came about?
Yes.
Oh.
Jack Chick. So they're called Chick
this
tracts.
This guy, I'm going to have to look him up.
Yeah. This is amazing.
Oh, no.
I mean, it's just amazing the different worlds that we come from, because, like, I, like, had stacks and stacks of these things. I don't remember giving them out. There was the famous one. It's like God is doing a This Is Your Life thing with a guy who's showing up at the Day of Judgment, and he's showing him every, you know, he's got a huge projector screen showing everything this person's ever done, good and bad. And the guy's like, oh, don't show that. Ooh, that was a bad day. Uh-oh, I messed this one up. And at the end, God's like, off to hell you go.
Wow.
Yeah, and that was the most popular
one. It seems like that's how they all end.
There's a lot of hell. Lots and lots and lots of hell in these things.
We didn't have anything like that. I just remember in Sunday school as a middle schooler, the closest thing I could think of was we had these little, they were probably a monthly little like magazine that we would get. We always looked forward to them though because they had, I don't know, it was kind of like what you were studying that month. They kind of incorporated some of that because it had maybe a study guide sort of effect, because all the Nazarene churches maybe could teach from this. I don't know that they all did, but they could. And then on the back was always our favorite because it was like the Dear Abby section for middle school church kids, and it was Ask Debbie and Dan. Uh-huh. And so they were like famous in the Nazarene church teen world.
Yeah, that's quite a different quite different
from I don't remember all the hell talk.
So yeah, that sounds a little bit more
normal.
A little too positive.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. But that was the only pamphlet type.
Okay.
It had cartoons, probably.
Okay, there we go. Yeah, we just had different cartoons.
Maybe not always, but yeah. If it did, it was positive.
Okay, well, I don't know how you keep people out of hell with all that positivity, so.
I don't know. I guess I'm going.
That's the spirit. Hey there, real quick note, this episode gets a little heavy toward the end in terms of religious trauma and self-harm ideation. Just a quick heads up. Time to lighten the mood a bit. Let's go with a question from Ben Wersowicz. What is the best time on the evangelical calendar? Ben asks. Children's Sunday, Easter, VBS, Harvest Festival, Summer Picnic, Christmas Party, Family Camp. VBS, of course. VBS is, to this day, quite frankly, is an excellent time on the calendar.
So the church that you went to, I mean, for a lot of your upbringing, still has a massive VBS program where you have to pre-register because it books up. It's insane. And this is still a thing. And so I can imagine that was probably a big thing for you.
My VBS years were at a smaller church. Yeah. So VBS, in case the thing this podcast is named after, if you're not familiar, it's like week-long activity thing for children in summer where kids show up. And we did it like all day. I've gathered for some kids at some churches, it's like a 5 to 9 type thing.
Yeah, we did a few hours in the evening.
Okay.
It's like an all-day thing.
Yeah. We did all day. There'd be games and activities and lessons and craft.
It's a lot. Well, obviously it had a lasting impression because that's what you decided to name this podcast.
It's a funny name for a podcast. I think it was what came to mind, and I never really
I think it works
considered
well.
Anything else. Yeah, like we took vacations from the Bible for a number of years and have now come back to it to put ourselves through Bible school, right?
Yeah,
and
we're
taking a vacation from the way that we were taught to read the Bible. And we would like this to feel like a little vacation from the way we're taught to be. You know what I mean? So, like, yeah.
There's a lot of ways that can be taken.
I would say my favorite time when I was at my churchiest, my favorite time was, you know, summer camp. We would go to the woods or to the beach with me and all my friends.
The beach for camp? That doesn't make sense. That's too fancy.
I mean, maybe you call it a retreat or something. But, okay. Yeah, we had numerous trips per year. Woods, beach, Gatlinburg, of course. Mm. Gatlinburg, Tennessee.
You had a lot of trips.
Oh, yeah, we took tons of trips. And what I have gathered, however, is that the Nazarene youth experience, there's not so much of this gallivanting around the country.
No, we did. I mean, certain churches were obviously bigger than the one that I went to, so some probably did more than we did. We did summer camp, and that was awesome, and we had a blast. But it was like we saved up all year to go to the summer camp that was probably $150 for the week. And they had all sorts of activities, and it was a few hours away. So that was fun, fine, whatever. But the big thing in the Nazarene Church is once every 4 years as a high schooler, you get to go to NYC, not New York City, Nazarene Youth Congress or conference. I can't remember which one it is.
Sounds like a blast.
It was amazing.
Okay.
So the year that I got to go, because since it's only once every 4 years, you only have one opportunity to go because you have to be a high schooler. We went to Toronto. It was the first time it was held out of the country, and it was awesome. We had no chaperones in our room.
Okay.
I'm not sure why. I think it was up to your church or your youth pastor or whoever was taking you, but I mean, our youth pastor was a male. I think his wife went, so I'm not really sure. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. Our room had no adult supervision, but we were all pretty good kids, so that was fine.
Oh, okay.
But we got to see a Red Hot Chili Peppers concert on the street.
Uh-huh.
And we wandered the streets of Toronto on our own as, like, 16-year-old girls.
Yeah.
Huh. And what was amazing, so while we're there, it's a week-long experience, and we flew, which was pretty huge for us at the time, and we had concerts and speakers every single night. So, like, you know, at the time, Audio Adrenaline was huge, and that was one of our concerts one night, and there were, like, 10,000 Nazarene kids gathered to watch Audio Adrenaline. We got to go on the field for the Toronto Blue Jays, and we had this giant fabric cross that we all held, all 10,000 of us, and we had an aerial view poster made of it.
Wow.
I don't even know where that is now, but yes, it was quite the experience.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, it was amazing.
This reminds me of several things. Well, so the lack of chaperones, that was definitely a thing for us, especially at beach camp, beach whatever you want to call it, mainly because we had so darn many kids. Usually we had a double bus load of kids, and you just cannot get that many grown-ups to commit to a week-long excursion dealing with teenagers. So, yeah, we had some understaffing issues, so we were good kids. See, I'll put that inflection on it, all right? You were good kids. We were good kids, okay? No major shenanigans that I would choose to report, but yeah, the staffing issues were notable. We had like tons of concerts and stuff. I remember we had Grits, the rap group, Out of Eden, the R&B group, lots and lots of rock groups. It's not too many punk groups, but yeah, like, and that was just at 1 year at Beach Fest that I'm thinking of.
Wow.
yeah, it was. It, looking back, it's like kind of embarrassing how much time we spent on entertainment stuff and how little we spent on like, hey, let's go, you know, work at like a soup kitchen.
Yeah, we did do more of that. Like so part of our big NYC was, it was also a mission trip built into this fun trip. So while we had concerts and fun speakers and there were like games and prizes, like we literally had a game hall where you could be like human bowling balls or Velcro walls or whatever. Like you could go visit that pretty much any time. But then we also had service times during the day where we would go, like the group that I was in, because you apply and they take your interests and things into consideration, and then you're assigned to a group based on where your strengths are. So mine was to go work at this kids camp, helping rebuild like their stage area or work with the kids for the day or whatever. It was kind of cool how they did that and assigned groups. So you weren't necessarily with kids from your church. Although I think some of those were. We did puppet shows for kids and stuff.
Good.
Those poor little Canadian kids.
Who never got to see puppets because they're illegal there. Yeah. It's funny taking this question in the context of like, you know, like the Catholic calendar. You know, you got this feast of the whoever, this feast of the whoever. This guy died 1,000 years ago. We need a feast to him. You know, right? Like that's the Catholic calendar. Whereas this is like, when do we get to go to the beach? That's my idea of the Protestant calendar.
I didn't see the beach till I was an adult, so I definitely didn't have any beach trips as a kid.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying. Yeah. It's not so much about like, oh, this guy died in the year 402, so we need to have a feast for him so that we can have a bountiful crop this year or whatever. I don't know.
Okay, question, cause this is kind of a tangent, but did you grow up doing communion often, or was it...
I really got no sense of the rhythm of doing it.
I feel like ours was like, it was really, Communion Sunday was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Like the church that I frequent most here does communion every Sunday. So it's a very different feeling from what I was brought up with.
Yeah, ours was infrequent, and if it was annual, that information did not stick in my mind. Like, I was often like, oh, there's grape juice in my hand, you know. And like, to be fair, I zoned out a lot in big church. I paid mostly attention in teen church. You know, who knows what I was doing that, like, I look up and, oh, the body of Christ is in my hand.
It was also a big deal for us at summer camp because at the end of the week, we had communion during one of our last services.
Hmm.
But other than that, it was also infrequent during church. But you had a lot more people to coordinate getting communion to.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yeah. It, like, literally anything else with us was, like, logistical effort. So
I'm pretty sure we had a person in our church who baked the bread.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. We definitely did the, like, it comes in a huge bag.
Right. And so ours had to be kind of planned in advance just for those purposes.
Hmm. So, yeah, I would say the best time in the evangelical calendar is whenever you get to go outside or there are fireworks or, you know, or, I thought of the most evangelical calendar thing is the wild game feast night. That was a thing.
Oh,
at ours.
No.
It was like this like men's thing, which like, you know, right there is like, why can't women eat snake meat and shark
Ew.
Meat and yeah it was
because it's disgusting. Also for grown men, and maybe some of the teenage boys if they continued on the evangelical path, would probably say Promise Keepers is a big event.
Oh, that was the other thing I want to mention. You mentioned being on the field for the Toronto baseball game. Yeah, I was taken to multiple Promise Keepers events as a youth. I went to some Washington D.C. Reclaim the Country thing.
I remember. I'm pretty sure my stepdad went.
Foot of the Washington Monument. Some dude was trying to blow a ram's horn. finally got it to work. I was the youngest dude on our bus. I'm pretty sure I was the only teenager. It was just me and like 40 dads.
and they were so proud of you.
Yeah. So the other Promise Keepers event I remember going to, it was at the Georgia Dome. And there was this thing where they brought all the kids down onto the field, and we all paraded around the field while all the dads, like, beat their chests, and, like, they did this thing where the dads were like, all right, and now clap your hands, and, like, they got it all coordinated so it sounded like a thunderstorm around us. And yeah, we sort of walked around, and the idea was like, look at all these men who are celebrating the next generation of Christian men who are going to reclaim this country for Christ and so on and so
you
forth.
You did a great job.
Yeah, that's still underway.
You're working on it now.
I'm not, but I remember just kind of walking around the floor of the stadium like, I guess this is not how I pictured myself being on the floor of the Georgia Dome, you know, sort of pictured doing it as like a star in the SEC championship. It's probably how I would have preferred to get there. But like, I remember relatives asking me about it for like weeks after that, like, how cool was that? And I'm like, you know, I was not a very impressible kid, you know, so just sort of like, it's fine. But that's my main Promise Keepers memory.
He's not a very impressible adult either.
I mean, everything is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But nothing is going to...
He's very chill.
It's just hard to bowl me over.
Our daughter and I are very excitable people, so, like, we look forward to things for a long time. We get really excited. But if you ask him if he's excited for anything, it's like, ask me when we're there.
Yeah. Well, and this way, like we decided the other day, this way it's harder for me to get disappointed if it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So if I do not get to parade around the floor of the Georgia Dome, which I do not anymore because it has been demolished, I will feel fine. Jamie Wilson has a question. Okay. Lacking any context, what's a single verse that feels most antithetical to the overall message of the book in which it resides? So in order to keep myself from trying to figure out the answer for all 66 books, which first would require like figuring out the message, like what's the message of Genesis, right? It's make babies, right? That's the message of Genesis, I think.
And then he kills all the people. So that actually kind of works.
And then you need more babies to replace the babies that God has killed. So Exodus literally story of liberation, ending slavery, ending bondage, people being wrenched away from empire, making their, you know, finally having self-determination. And what does Exodus have? As almost literally one of the first things that happens once they're finally clear of the Pharaoh. Exodus has verses on how certain kinds of slavery are cool. The book of Exodus. So I would say that's pretty antithetical. The other one, a book called Revelation, is about nothing but secret codes. Revelation. Revealing. Sharing knowledge. Making you smarter. Making you know what I'm talking about. And it's nothing but gibberish. That it's all code about Emperor Nero and being scared of Rome and so on and so forth. Which, like, I like the message, right? It's anti-empire. Great. Again, like Exodus, it's anti-empire. But it also has broken brains to this day, made people think that, you know, the world is ending any minute now and we can predict this, and so we need to storm the Capitol and take the country back for Jesus. And hey, it's those guys again.
Did you think that Revelation broke your brain?
For a time, sure. Yes. For a time, yeah. As a, I was mostly over that type of stuff around, like, I'd say before high school. The year 2000 was kind of like a make or break. Like, so many of the, like, so much of the Revelation business was based around the year 2000.
Right.
That, like, once it came and went, it was just kind of like, huh. All that fuss was just so those guys could sell books. But yeah.
They did.
They did. Yeah. So, like, grew up soaking in that stuff. And, I mean, it's got a lot of explosions. And who doesn't like that? So, but yeah, Revelation. You should actually reveal things if you're going to call yourself Revelation. Next up from Hoover Street Rag is Toad the Wet Sprocket's Fly from Heaven, an exceedingly reasonable reading of the feelings of the apostles toward Paul in Acts. I was not familiar with this song. I really don't know much anything about this band. But yeah, these lyrics are... So the idea of this song is written from the point of view of Jesus' brother, who is kind of... it opens with the lyrics. Paul is making me nervous. Paul is making me scared. Walk into this room and swaggers like he's God's own messenger. Change the name of my brother from Jesus of Nazareth to Jesus the Christ. Change the things that he said, and boy, you could have a whole discussion there about how the message of the Gospels is not exactly a perfect sync with the message of the Epistles. More lyrics. Says that he speaks to him, but he never even knew the man. And yeah, this is a pretty fascinating song. And if you read the book of Acts, there is a lot of tension between, you know, the guys who were there, the guys who grew up with Jesus, and this guy barreling in, said he's had a weird dream and he's kind of in charge of the whole world now. These guys can, you know, they can minister to people in Jerusalem, but I'm going to go take this and, you know, we're going worldwide. And Paul's the one who takes the message everywhere. And Peter and them, they're kind of like, yeah, sounds great. You do that. Then we won't have to look at you anymore. So like, there's this tension. These guys don't get along all that well.
Song is anti-Paul.
Yeah, to a certain extent. Yeah, and it gets at this idea of like the people who were around listening to Jesus's message. There is, you know, as far as the Gospels relay, there's a really, really good chance that they all thought that Jesus was literally coming back imminently, that the world was literally going to end, because if you read Jesus without the context of the the 1900 years in between, you get the sense that what he was saying is the world is about to end imminently. And you can take this, you know, you can say, was he talking about the actual physical world, or is he talking about the kingdom of humanity, the kingdom of empire that we can choose to replace at any point with a kingdom more like God's? There's a lot you can say about what Jesus said, but this song, it gets at the idea of like how difficult it would be to see your brother, you know, your hero, the person you saw in real life, saying things about how, you know, we are going to remake this place better. And then seeing some guy come along and form this huge mystical religion with code words and salvation and all this stuff. And yeah, that had to be a trip. So like, thank you, Hoover Street, for sharing this song. Yeah. And, speaking of kind of the idea of, you know, what we made of Jesus, we as a species, made of Jesus shortly after he exited, and it was sort of up to Paul and others to sort of piece together a coherent religion once you deal with the fact that, oh, the world's still here. A personages on Twitter asks, what is the wildest historical Christian heresy? So, I wanted to play a game. Heresy is kind of a funny word, because like, we take it to mean this day to mean thing I disagree with, you know, or thing my church disagrees with, or thing my favorite pastor disagrees with. But like, it has a definition. Most commonly, it would mean a thing that the Catholic Church has said is just incredibly, incredibly wrong. A thing that the Catholic Church has said just does not fly. And some of these things are kind of retroactive in a way, because the Catholic Church, you know, it formed within the first few hundred years after Jesus, and they sort of said like, okay, this thing you guys have been saying for hundreds of years now, that's actually wrong now. So Emily, I wanted to play a little game. I want to lightning round through all of them on the wiki page. Okay, and you can react however you like as we go.
Yeah, I haven't heard this yet, so
okay.
This is
perfect. Heresy number one on the wiki: adoptionism, belief that Jesus was born as a mere non-divine man, was supremely virtuous, later adopted as Son of God. How do you feel about that?
No.
No? Okay. Because the Gospel of Mark kind of hints that that's how it could be. The Gospel of Mark, we open with the baptism at the hands of John the Baptist, and then the Spirit of God descends on Jesus. And it's, if you take out the Gospel of Matthew or the Gospel of Luke, then the Gospel of Mark could
be. So I don't disagree with all of it. I just disagree with the adoption portion.
All right, we'll find the heresy for you then, okay?
Okay.
Next up, Apollinarism, belief that Jesus had a human body and lower soul, the seat of the emotions, but a divine mind. A man with a human heart and a divine mind. Something like that. Which, I mean, I really don't see how that's a heresy. You're being really picky. Like, I think that's the entire idea.
Yeah, I was kind of trying to find the trouble with that one.
I'm going to say that whoever declared to be a heresy in 381 by the First Council of Constantinople, you guys are being really picky.
which part of that didn't they agree with?
Next, okay. Arabisi, just rolling with that, belief that the soul perished with the body and that both would be revived on Judgment Day. Dog, who cares? No one knows.
That is a thing a lot of people believe.
There's so many arguments about whether the body comes with the soul,
right,
and the soul is part of the... So many arguments about that.
I would like to believe otherwise, but...
Which part?
About the soul dying with the body. I think that the soul continues on at that point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Coleridianism, belief that this is a fun one. Belief that the Trinity consists of the Father, Son, and Mary, and that the Son is a result of marital union between the other two.
Heresy.
You don't like that?
No.
Okay. I like it. I wouldn't say it is what is necessarily taught in the Bible, but I think it's a cool story.
The weird thing for me is, even though through this podcast I'm learning so much and reading and doing all these things that I never thought to delve into as a kid, I still have very traditional views on a lot of things because that's what I know.
Uh-huh.
But I'm okay with challenging that, but this just no.
Okay. Docetism. Belief that Jesus' physical body was an illusion, as was his crucifixion. That is, Jesus only seemed to have a physical body and to physically die.
No. Mm-hmm.
This was kind of ridiculous.
This is a silly, silly magic trick.
This one sounds absurd in hindsight, right? And like we know the story of like Jesus shows Thomas his wounds and all this stuff, and we've taught that theology is very important.
He was a hologram.
We're taught that the theology very much matters, that God suffered, you know, that the sacrifice and all this stuff. But at the time when people were arguing about how could a being be both fully man and fully God, you know, this was an argument that made sense to a lot of people. I would say it is not it has less biblical support than the idea that Jesus did have a physical body. I'll say that.
Well, people touched him, so
yes.
That'd be pretty weird if no one ever touched him.
Macedonians. While accepting the divinity of Jesus Christ, they denied that of the Holy Spirit, which they saw as a creation of the Son and a servant of the Father and the Son. So basically,
I mean, this is a place where I don't know what's right, so... I don't know. I can't argue one way or another with this one.
This is nitpicky crap to me. I don't know, man. Okay, did the Holy Spirit make God then? If you make it a perfect circle like that, then like, okay, that's a cool story. But like, we don't know. The Trinity's only in the Bible if you really want it to be. Next, Melchizedekians.
What?
I don't think you're going to like this one. Considered some guy named Melchizedek. Oh, sorry. I guess it's just Melchizedek. An incarnation of the divine word, and identified him with the Holy Ghost. Sorry. Sorry, pal. No.
Nope. Don't like it.
Monarchianism. An overemphasis on the indivisibility of God the Father at the expense of the other persons of the Trinity. So this one kind of branches whether you... take away divinity from Jesus or from the Spirit and say God is supreme over one or the other, and like it's all ticky-tack Trinity garbage. Like,
yeah.
No one knows. No one knows, man.
Maybe someday we'll find out.
Yeah, well. Monophysitism. Belief that Christ's divinity dominates and overwhelms his humanity. And then there's also the opposite, which says he's more human than divine. And like, people spent hundreds of years arguing about
it. It's funny. A lot of these kind of go together.
Yes.
That's like one of the first one I think that you read that was, I think he was born mortal or born human and grew into that. So to me, they all kind of go together.
It's just awesome that people spent so many years coming up with exact formulas. We're spending seconds. Equations. It's just good to be remembered, even if it's for a few seconds. I mean, this one again is like, yeah, this is fine. This is fine. This didn't need to be, you know, there didn't need to be a big thing about this.
They didn't have iPads and stuff back then, though, so they needed things to do.
I just mean, like, in terms of the Catholic Church making a big thing of this.
Right.
Man, who cares? Is Jesus 51% human, 51% spirit, or dead even down the middle, or 100% of both? Fine.
But what is that? What I want to know is, what does it change one way or the other?
That's the thing.
Yeah. So, does it change your beliefs if one is greater
than
the other?
We are coming from a privileged position where this has been a quote-unquote settled question for hundreds and hundreds of years, right? Like, if no one had come along and declared all these things wrong, I don't know, we might be arguing to this day about, you know, whether I think Jesus is 62% human. Well, I think it's 63%, you heretic.
61.5, thank you.
Oh, you're the heretic now. Monothelitism, belief that Jesus Christ had two natures but only one will. Contrary to the Orthodox interpretation, which teaches that Jesus had two wills, human and divine, corresponding to his two natures. I prefer...
Just like the other one.
I prefer one will, two natures.
Right.
I will stand with... whose fault was this one? It doesn't say, and I'm not clicking another link to learn more. But it makes more sense to me. One mind, wrestling between the two.
I think that's what that was kind of the point of Jesus, right?
Yeah, a two brains in one body, then no, that's his bad story. That's what I come down to. What's the best story? And a one human brain struggling to be both. That is the best story.
Maybe someone should make an Inside Out movie with that, the two minds wrestling each other, the divine and the human. That would be a fascinating
Inside Out
weird movie.
And they say he was a man of constant sorrows, so the little blue character is
sadness
wins.
Yes.
Nestorianism is, of course, the belief that Jesus Christ was a natural union between the flesh and the Word, thus not identical to the divine Son of God. Dog, who cares? Come on, get out of my sight. What is the difference? Stop. Patripassianism. I like this one. Belief that the Father and the Son are not two distinct persons, and thus God the Father suffered on the cross as Jesus. This is the best story of all. This is the best possible story you can tell about Jesus. God in heaven, the eternal, all mystery, the creator of the universe, the thing that was around before the Big Bang, entered a human body.
He sent himself,
entirely.
Not his son.
Yes. Yes, it was not a mission. It was not God up there like blah blah blah, pointing and gesturing, and you go do this thing, this being that is also me or whatever. Heaven was vacant.
I don't know how
God
feel about
this.
God
did this job himself. God the Father looked at heaven and said, "Why have you forsaken me?" Not even realizing that it was God the Father on the cross. This is the best possible story in the whole Bible. I'm a Patripassianist.
I think it makes for a very interesting story, but I don't know that I'm on board with it.
Yes. Well, I love the theology of it also, because
it is fascinating.
This is the moment when God finally learns what it means to love people, when God fear, when God learns love.
That's why I think I find it fascinating, because for so long, as we see in the books that we've covered up to this point, he basically has to learn how to love humans. Like, he creates them thinking it's going to be this easy little task, and then he wants to kill them all the time. So insert himself into the situation is pretty fascinating.
Yes. So I think if you take the entire Hebrew and Christian Bibles combined and you try to tell a complete story, what do we have? We have God creates and gets frustrated and he breaks things and he's mad. And then he kind of takes a step back. We talked about it in our Mount Sinai episode a little bit, about the story of God fades away over the course of the Hebrew Bible. He's directly involved. He's blowing stuff up. And then he teaches prophets how to blow stuff up. And then he steps away and further away and further away. And then there's the book of Esther that's like not about God at all. And like by the end of the Hebrew Bible, God has handed the world over to people. And then what happens is this guy is born, right? Heaven is still silent. Heaven is silent to this day. But if you tie these things together, if you're a passionate Patripassianist as I am, then what you have is God finally cracked the code, made her way into our reality, and learned. And then what happens with those lessons that God learned? I guess we'll find out. Probably takes a while to run these lessons throughout the entire multiverse and so on and so forth. But I don't know. This is the best possible.
Well, and they talk about how an angel of the Lord appeared to tell Mary and Joseph. It's not the Lord appearing any longer. So
yeah. So what do we have as we go from the booming voice of God to, like, I saw an angel, right? I had a dream. Like,
right,
that happens even within
the
course of Genesis.
In the Old Testament, so far, there are no angel encounters like that, except for in the time of Noah.
Yeah, yeah.
But not communicating through
our
angels.
Our idea of angels, like this fluttering bird person and all that, like, even within, like, Genesis, it's difficult. Like, there's three people approach Abraham and Sarah, and two walk down to get Lot, right? And who are these people? These must be angels. Well, these are manifestations of God. That's what angels are. Angels are either they were sort of vestigial Canaanite minor gods, or they were images of God. An angel basically just means God in a physical place or some combination thereof. And, by the time we got to the New Testament, it became just messenger of God. And that fits the story.
And they're all of God, though they're not.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the wording changes.
No one in the New Testament sees God.
Right.
It's until, Revelation, we get thundering, booming messages from heaven. But then who's delivering them? It's Jesus on a white horse with a flaming sword and all this stuff, right? Like, God is virtually silent for the entire New Testament, except for there's a bird and there's a voice and this is my son. That's passing the baton. This is now God. Is that I have become this guy, right? Like, heaven is empty and all of God is in one human's body. That's the best possible story.
And you start to see why studying the Bible is so fascinating.
Yeah. And like, you know, if you'd said all this to me when I was in eighth grade, I would have probably just cried and slapped you or something.
Probably
because,
did.
Because no, you, the sacrifice is the whole point. And but yeah, I get the sacrifice, but this is a better story. Okay.
I just view it as two different things. There's what I believe and then there's all the fascinating stories. That's and fine. Sometimes they go together and sometimes they don't.
Yeah. The next, of course, is solanthropism. Belief that Jesus is merely human, either that he never became divine or that he never existed. How did y'all get in here?
That's
like,
weird.
This is, what are you guys doing in here? Like, this is the first one that I'm like, okay, I see why you had to call this a heresy. Like, I see how this didn't fit in your religion. Okay. Solanthropism. All right, you're fine.
That's
you're
fascinating
heresy.
To feel that. Do they believe that Jesus returned 3 days later?
Oh, I mean, apparently not. I'm not going to learn more, but this seems like the first easy one to really vote off the island, like, right? Like, there's some.
I mean, there have been a few for me, but.
But, like, if we're wrestling over, like, I think the Trinity is actually 34% Father.
This is just that kid that walks up, like, hey, I think, go home.
Yeah, you're at the first. Oh, this is the first council in Nicaea. This one got slapped down pretty quickly. Someone just walked up and said, I think Jesus was fake. And they're like, dude, we're here to discuss the actual, you know, controversies. Everyone here, this is a unanimous vote. Go away. Sabellianism. Belief that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are three characterizations of one God rather than three distinct persons in one God. Nerd! Stop! Who cares? That's the same thing. Tritheism. Belief that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are three independent and distinct divine beings as a... Go away! That's the same thing! Next section. Gnosticism. Whoo boy. So the Gnostics get their entire whole section of their own on the wiki page. Gnosticism. It's a lot of things. It's treated as this, like, you know, this awful, horrible, dangerous cult. That's what the Catholics have told us, right? That's everything we know about the Gnostics, more or less. We either dug out of the ground or we learned the Catholic version. We learned what Catholics told us about their vanquished enemies, the Gnostics. They believed a lot of weird stuff, and Jesus was kind of this, like pothead mystic in a lot of their writings. And, you know, he says some nice stuff. He also says some weird stuff, but that's kind of par for the course. The main basic idea that gets associated a lot with Gnostic is it's very dualist, very good versus evil, which, yes, this becomes part of Christianity. There's this popular idea among the Gnostics that the God that we see in the Hebrew Bible is more or less the bad God, and then there's a good God sort of encircling beyond. And, I mean, there's a lot of ways to take that, but, like, there are antagonist gods in the Hebrew Bible. Hebrew Bible God is an antagonist at times. He flooded the world, for one thing.
Yeah.
So, like, we've talked a lot about on this show about the idea of God has so many aspects, it's almost like we're talking about different characters. And if we go from the viewpoint of, like, when these things were written, we were. But, like, the Gnostics would look, and that's how they would sew everything together, is they would say the God that came to earth in the form of Jesus, Jesus was that God's way of defeating and vanquishing the mean aspect of God. And, you know, you could read this as, like, anti-Semitic and, like, against the Jewish idea of God. If this feels a little too close to that, then, okay, yes, let us reject this. The thing I like about the Gnostics is being comfortable with saying, like, yeah, God did bad stuff. Jesus does really weird stuff at times in the New Testament. And sort of wrestling with, like, you don't have to say everything God does is perfect. And if the way to deal with that is to say there are multiple gods and they're battling, then...
Do you ever remember being told or taught that God did bad things?
No. No.
You're... Right.
The flood was totally justified.
Right. Everything turned into happy times.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything God did was completely justified. And if it didn't make any sense, then I don't know. You need to pray about it.
I mean, I feel like I remember being taught at different points that, you know, God was angry or whatever, but never reflecting on him in a poor light.
Yeah.
It was always the humans were the wrong ones, which, I mean, humans are often wrong. That's fine.
Yeah,
but,
sure. I mean, yeah. Of course we are. Look who made us. Yeah, but I mean, like, God regrets. We said it in our separate episode.
Yeah.
God regretted making people, and then God regretted destroying people. So, what more do you need? Here is a Gnostic sect, I think, has a really good story. The Sethians, of course, they believe that the snake in the Garden of Eden was an agent of the true God who brought knowledge of truth to man. I love it. It's a fantastic story.
I feel
the
like
snake,
you...
The snake reads as a god. It's the Bible's Loki.
I think we talked about that kind of in our first episode, or second episode anyway.
Yeah. How'd the snake get there? Yeah. How did the snake get there? God created everything in the garden, right? So which one was God? Was it the guy walking around and testing people and making up weird rules and telling people not to learn knowledge?
Or maybe it was both of them.
Was it the guy who was guarding procreation and telling Eve she's a bad person for learning how to procreate and kicking people out and all that? Or was it the snake who said, it's okay to be smart. It's okay to learn the knowledge of good and evil and all the metaphors that that could stand for. Which one told the truth? It was the snake, because they did not die on the day, like the character God said. So, yeah, Sethians, I stand with you.
They both are kind of right.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
Here's my people again. The Ophites, very similar, believe that the serpent who tempted Adam and Eve was a hero, and that the God who forbade Adam and Eve to eat from the tree of knowledge is the enemy. Yes, yeah.
I feel like they must be looked at from other religious groups as, like, heathens.
Well, yeah, they're heretics.
Yeah, but I mean, just how can you think, like, they must be devil worshippers, like, is
yeah, I mean,
what that sounds like.
I don't know. I grew up, I was taught Eden is about the fall, Eden is Satan, Eden is when everything was corrupted, and we ruined everything, and we're wallowing in all our bad, sad shame, and gross grime, and we're horrible, and everything has sucked ever since then, but read the story. Strip all that stuff away, just read the story just once. Who's the hero
here?
Like,
without any background information.
Just set your theology in a box, set it to the side, and you can put it back in your brain as soon as you're done reading it. This is the story of Prometheus. This is the story of humans defying God, humans becoming mortal, humans exchanging immortality for creation, for procreation, for exchanging immortality for humanity, consciously choosing the tree of knowledge over the tree of life. It's an origin story that explains why people are people and people are not angels. That's it.
I feel like this is like every YA dystopian novel.
Yes!
Like every single one of them stems from this.
Yeah.
And everyone chooses that path.
And like,
or else it wouldn't be a good book.
In the Hunger Games and Star Wars and all of them, who are you supposed to root for? The kid who breaks the rules. The kid who says, no,
who
I'm not
going
to sit here and avoid, you know, the path of knowledge, the path of self-discovery. I will defy you, unstoppable beast monster. Who's right? It's the kid who breaks the rule.
I'm a pretty big fan of YA dystopian novels, so.
Other Christian heresies. Antinomianism, any view which holds that Christians are freed by grace from obligations of any moral law. Like, okay. So.
We got some of those. I mean.
This one is basically someone who read a little bit of Paul and just ran wild with it.
This is funny because think about all the people these days who would be like, no, who are acting just in this manner.
Sure. Sure, yeah. So this is someone who said, like, Paul said, I don't have to follow the law anymore. Well, but Jesus said you did, so.
Storm the Capitol!
Well, there's that. Audianism, belief that God has human form, and that one ought to celebrate Jesus' death during the Jewish Passover. I mean, okay.
I mean, wasn't Jesus' human form?
I think it's the idea. And you know, some people believe to this day that God has human form. Okay, fine. I would say it's very big.
Joan Osborne believed that.
Very big, big form, right? And if we look up in the sky, we're just looking at, like, the eyeball of God and what have you. So, okay. This is probably an easy one to slap down. The word looks French. I assume it's not. But it actually, it feels very French once you get the definition of it. The Berilot heresy. I know that's not how it's pronounced.
You should have seen the hand gestures there.
It was more of an Italian gesture. These folks believe they held all things in common as Jesus taught and as Paul taught, including wives and children. Hang on, folks.
Wait a minute.
I think I see where you took that one a little too far, fellas. The Donatists were rigorists, holding that the church must be a church of saints, not sinners. Sacraments administered. This is just.
How do they have any members? That's what I want to know. Were they all Jesus?
Sort of just died
they had
out.
One member, and it was Jesus.
It gets worse because there's the Circumcellions, who were a militant subset of Donatists.
The Circumcellions. So wonder what they did with their time.
These guys sound awful. The Ebionites, a Jewish sect that insisted on the necessity of following Jewish law. The Ebionites regarded Jesus as the Messiah, but not as divine.
Huh.
They also had a thing. They were very poor. In a lot of ways, I think these are the most early Christian type people. They were Jewish, followed the Jewish law. They gave up property, like Jesus said. And they said, hey, Jesus was very cool. He was very awesome. He said a lot of good things. He was the Messiah. I think if you're looking for people who were like, you know, the next generation of Christian after Jesus died, the Ebionites, in my mind, are very, very close. I don't want to say the purest, and I definitely don't want to say the most correct, but I think they were the people who took, as far as we know, the message Jesus was trying to convey in the Gospels and applied it literally. Follow the law, give up all your stuff, and wait for things to happen. This next one has 5 bullet points. That's too much. I'm not reading
that.
There
are a lot of these.
This one's more Trinity garbage. Iconoclasm, the belief that icons are idols and should be destroyed. You can see why the Catholics had a problem with that one. Marcionism, affirmed Jesus Christ as the Savior sent by God and Paul as his chief apostle, but rejected the Hebrew Bible and the Hebrew God. To me, this is, okay, you're doing the Gnostic thing, but I don't know, you're being way less fun and mystical about it, so this is boring. The Montanists, belief that the prophecies of... Okay, so this is just a cult. They had their own... Yeah, whatever. Get out of my sight. anytime there's one of these, there's like... The Montanists believed that they had a prophet who was smarter than Jesus, and right. You're at the wrong club, right? Start your own church. Pelagianism believed that original sin did not taint human nature. Mortal will is still capable of choosing good or evil without divine aid. Yes, that's correct.
That
next up, medieval heresies. Oh, gosh. The Bogomils. Not looking up how to pronounce it. It's more Gnostics. Catharism. This is a pretty famous one. Yeah, this was a big one. This one led to the Catholics killing a lot of people and stuff. So it was basically, denied that Jesus could become incarnate and still be the Son of God. So again, this is literally hundreds and hundreds of years after Jesus. We're still arguing about percentages, and thousands of people died because the Catholics didn't like this. The Free Spirit heresy, mixed mystical beliefs with Christianity. Okay, so did Jesus.
That's it.
Next, Fraticelli. I'm doing the Italian gesture again. Extreme proponents of the rule of Saint Francis of Assisi, who is he was a pretty cool guy. He was into Christians should be poor and give their money away to poor people and stuff. So, extreme proponents of his. I'm guessing these folks were pretty cool. I apologize if they're not. this next one has too many bullet points. Not reading that. Here we go. The most ticky-tack, nitpicky one. You ready? Triclavianism, belief that 3 rather than 4 nails were used to crucify Christ, and that a Roman soldier pierced him with a spear on the left rather than right side.
Who cares? Why does it matter?
Next up, Protestantism. Hi there.
Hi.
And then some Counter-Reformation stuff. And at this point, it's all all right, we Christian orthodoxy is settled and established, and now we're just arguing, Jehovah's Witnesses, what's up, folks? Scrolling Mormons, hey, y'all. Americanism.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. A group of related heresies, which is defined as the endorsement of full freedom of the press, liberalism, individualism, and separation of church and state. Again, you can see why the Catholics didn't like this. Modernism, evolution of dogma in time and space. So that one's really vague. That one's kind of like the we don't like critical race theory of Catholic heresies. Modernity is bad. Reincarnationism, belief that certain people are used to blah, blah, blah. It's okay. I think you're in the wrong religion, but that's okay. That's okay. If you think, Mary can reincarnate, that's fine. It's just probably going to need to start your own religion. And that's basically it. That's pretty much it. We just went through all the heresies. Found a couple to like. A lot of them were pretty easy to just discard. But
moving on.
So that's a long answer. Next, from
Kevin Gallen.
What is the single most terrifying verse in the entire Bible? Do you have an answer by chance?
I don't.
Okay. The one that me and some of my cohorts would have pointed at in high school would have been Jesus when there's an he's sitting around, he's casting out demons and stuff, and there's an argument about who can cast out demons. And Jesus, sometimes he just says weird stuff that maybe the people who are standing right there in front of him knew what he meant. Maybe the people who are writing it down knew what he meant. And maybe the people who are reading it, you know, for the first time, like 50 years after he was gone, could figure out what he meant. But when we read it now, we're like, okay. But here's the verse. Matthew 12, verse number 31. Therefore I tell you, every sin and blasphemy will be forgiven, but blasphemy against the Spirit will not be forgiven. And whoever speaks a word against the Son of Man will be forgiven, but whoever speaks against the Holy Spirit will not be forgiven either in this age or in the age to come.
I thought he was all about forgiveness.
How do you know whether you've spoken against the Holy Spirit or not? So, yeah, that one, I remember as a teenager, that was when we sort of sat around like, how do we avoid doing that? Because this is the big one. This is the really big one. This is bigger than all the sins they tell us are big ones. This is bigger than voting Democrat or having a girlfriend or any of the things that are really bad. This sounds worse than having an abortion.
Wow.
Yeah. But, like, I don't know, man. Whatever Jesus was saying right then, it would have been very cool if he had clarified a little bit, because whatever in the world it means is it's heavy stuff. From John, would it be possible to discuss the history of how some books made it into the Bible while others were rejected? So, yeah, this is obviously this is a really, really, really big one. I think the really short version is that, like, it was a lot of dudes sitting around arguing. And that's pretty much it. So, like, even the Hebrew Bible, I think we have the idea that the Hebrew Bible was like this settled book that then Jesus showed up and then people argued about what is being added to it. But actually, both canons were quote-unquote finalized-ish around the same time-ish, as far as we know. Like, even after Jesus, Jews were still arguing about Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, some other books about whether they should make the cut into their main collection of scriptures or not. So the story of the Hebrew Bible is something like, you know, basically what we have is what Ezra or whoever at the end of the Hebrew Bible story just walks up and says, here is the collection of scriptures that, you know, these are our most sacred things. And then as far as we know, that was the scriptures that then rabbis then debated about, like, well, does all this stuff make it in, blah, blah, blah. Then the early Christian church, they took that, they had the Gospels, and as far as we know, it's been the same set of four Gospels almost basically the entire time. As far as we know, Christians primarily accepted those four. There are Gnostic Gospels, there's a Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of, you know, every character in the Gospels has their own Gospel, and it's you know, usually written well after the fact, written in their name. There's a Gospel of Peter that has a cross that is like 100 feet tall and walks around. Yeah. There's wild stuff in those.
I don't remember learning about that.
Yeah. But as far as we know, the four Gospels were the four Gospels almost the entire time. And we're talking, you know, when they're written, which is likely around 80 Common Era to 100 Common Era, somewhere in there. And then, you know, the works of Paul. Everyone hung on to those, and the Catholics sat around and said, like, all right, this is, and there's kind of a lot of fuzzy history in there where it wasn't like exactly one day, you know, someone just slammed down on a desk and says, this is the canon, but like, the canon was just roughly generally agreed on for hundreds and hundreds of years, and then Martin Luther came along and, like, started throwing stuff out of the Hebrew Bible that he thought didn't belong, and then, yeah. That's pretty much it. One shout out to the Ethiopian church for canonizing everything with an 81 book Bible.
That's a lot of books.
It's an incredible. The Catholics, they have more Jewish books than even the Hebrew Bible does. Like, they have the Maccabees is in the Catholic Bible, and it's like that's the story of Hanukkah.
Interesting.
That's always been funny to me. All right, so yeah, the canonization process is just like you could read 10 entire books about it, but the short version is just guys sat around and argued, and then. From Mike Altman, whomst you should follow on Twitter for a mixture of pro wrestling thoughts and religious studies thoughts. Mike asks, what are your favorite names in the Bible? Mike says his are Naomi's two sons' names, which mean, like, about to die and very sick. They then die immediately in the story. Like, Naomi's son, Malin, his name apparently means very sick. And then guess what happens to him? I grabbed a few. There is Achan, which his name means trouble, and he's stoned to death because he steals stuff during the...
I feel like we talked about this in one of the earlier episodes about how the names were too on point, and it was almost like it felt like they were named after the fact because of that.
Kind
of,
yeah.
Yeah, this would go along with that theory.
Delilah, who takes away Samson's power, Samson the big strong hero, her name means weak. Owned. he got depowered by the weak girl. Job, who has the hardest time of anybody in the Bible, his name means persecuted and hated. Seems accurate.
Yeah.
Methuselah, the oldest man in the Bible, his name means man of the dart. Old guys like darts. You know, old guys like going down to the bar and playing darts. That one makes a lot of sense.
There were a lot of bars back then.
Mordecai, who is a character in the book of Esther that people get named after to this day. His name means servant of Marduk, an ancient Babylonian god. So if you know someone named Mordecai and they're like, I'm named this because it's in the Bible, shout out to Marduk, the ancient, it's sort of one of the ancient all-father gods of the Babylonian pantheon, living on to this day in the name of people named Mordecai. And shout out a very important name, Israel, meaning God contends, fighting God, struggling with God, wrestling with God. This is the name Jacob gets for the act of wrestling against an angel, God, his brother, some mixture of things. But it forms one of the themes and lessons of the Bible, which is that, again, just like Eve did, challenge God. And yeah, so those are some pretty good names.
So I don't really have a favorite name from the Bible necessarily, but... there's a family that used to work for me, and this particular son didn't work for me, but all of the kids, there were 12 kids in this family, and all of them had 6 letters in their name, and they all had an R, and somehow they were all biblical. I don't know how they all fit in, because they weren't all obviously biblical, but this one was. I'm pretty sure he was the oldest son. He's named after the book of Deuteronomy. His name is Deuter.
Deuter!
So maybe that's one of your future children's names, too.
You dear listener, if you would like to use that name, feel free. We did not come up with Deuter.
Yeah, it's just that name. I will never forget it.
It's a very good name. I mean, and technically it's a biblical name, so yeah.
Yeah.
Charles writes in with a small, simple question. Do animals have souls?
Yeah, and then I'll probably expand as you speak, but yes, I don't know why they wouldn't.
Okay.
The thing is, heaven is supposed to make people happy, right? Like, it's supposed to be a good place. How could you go to heaven without your pets? Like, of course animals have souls. Uh-huh. It's silly to think otherwise.
So, if I were to unpack this question, the word that I would continually trip over and need to wrestle my way past is souls. Because there are animals in Genesis 1. Are there souls in Genesis 1? Are there souls in Genesis? Are there souls in the Hebrew Bible? To varying degrees, the question is somewhere between no, yes, and maybe. The concept of a soul in the Bible is not totally, 100% clearly, undoubtedly a thing until Paul comes along and he's talking about flesh versus spirit. In the Hebrew Bible, there is an idea that when you die, there is some sort of mystic presence that leaves your body, and your body goes down into the grave, and your body is just done, dead, gone. And then there's something that leaves your body. In the Hebrew Bible, it's called the breath, the spirit. It's this animating part of your body that once you die is no longer yours and it returns. And if it's the breath of God, where does it go? Back to God, which is kind of a beautiful idea, right? When you die, your spirit goes back to God. Your spirit was on loan from God the entire time. The thing that you thought you were was actually just part of God. And that's beautiful and that's wonderful. So if that is the clearest idea for the majority of the Bible, regarding a thing that could be defined as a soul. Like, you know, think about the thousand years process of the Bible coming about. Like when Paul is talking, we're talking well after Plato, the Greeks, the Romans. Paul's a Roman citizen. Jesus, you know, in the time of the Roman Empire. They're hearing all these ideas about the soul and immaterial ghosts that go down to Hades and all this stuff. That was not necessarily part of the world in which the Israelites grew up around, you know, Canaanites. With them, it was, you're dead. Your body's in the ground. What do you mean you're somewhere? No, you're dead. You're in the ground. And, like, the stuff that was you, the stuff that animated you, is gone. It floated back up, and it's back into God's nostrils. That's where the part of you that animated you now is. So where did that spirit come from? In Genesis 1, we are taught, the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. Genesis 1:30, God says, this breath of life, this animating breath of the Spirit, that is, as far as we know in the entire Hebrew Bible, this is the idea that most closely matches the idea of the soul. God says, Genesis 1:30, beasts, birds, creatures, insects, that all these things have the breath of life in them. Also, what does God say when he creates humans? He says he blesses them and he says they're good. That's what he says after he makes fish, birds, livestock, so on and so forth. So I think the argument, do animals have souls? Genesis 1 would say yes.
Yeah, if you say people do, then Genesis says yes. But for whatever reason, I grew up feeling like everyone always would say, well, animals don't have souls. But where does that come from? Why do people say that?
Yeah. What's a soul? Is what I constantly go back to. Like, why are we so certain we know what a soul is? Like, I mean, you know, why do we respond to animals the way we do? Why do we look at a puppy dog and feel like we're looking at a human baby? Like, why do we have that need to take care of, you know, if you see a baby duck in a street, why do you want to find its mother? We don't do that with rocks. We have a kinship with animals that we don't have with other stuff in the universe. What animates them is also what animates us. Just because we can think about what animates us, does that really make us different, right?
I mean, I like animals more than people on some days, so how could that be if they don't have souls?
Think about how many times God is compared to an animal in the Bible. I mean, I would bet God is compared to an animal more times than God is compared to a person. Like, yes, God is referred to with, like, male human pronouns and stuff, but, like, God is compared to a bird, constantly to birds, to lions, right? To animals constantly, to forces of nature. God is identified at least as much with animals in the Bible as God is with people. So, do animals have souls? If I have a soul, then animals have souls is the way I see it. And maybe, you know, maybe we have varying degrees of it. To me, consciousness, human consciousness, is the clearest example for souls, God, all of it. And animals have some degree of that same animating factor that we do. Is it enough to qualify as a soul? I think so. If souls are real, animals have souls, is how I feel. Speaking of, from Buzzwole on Twitter, do Christians secretly or not so secretly wish for death? If I was 100% convinced heaven was real and was a paradise, and I was 100% sure I had my ticket to the dance, every time a semi-truck passed by me, I'd be thinking, please take me out, send me to paradise, Mr. Trucker. So,
so I would say that growing up, I was 100% okay with dying.
Okay.
But I was not wishing for it.
Okay.
Now that I have, like, a family, my thoughts have changed on that. I want every moment I can have. But it is weird. Like, I remember when Columbine happened and that big story came out about the girl who one of the shooters asked, do you believe in God? And that whole thing was very big in the church. And
the big fake story.
But it was like, that was something we all discussed. Would we be willing to stand up for our faith? And it was like, heck yes.
Right.
And feeling like that would have been a badge of honor to have gone out in that manner. And feeling like I would have been totally okay with that. It's just really weird thinking about that now. And how even if I am 100% certain that I will go to heaven, there are too many moments to be missed. And I feel like life is what makes heaven worth it, is you've had these experiences and you've lived through these things. And my life, and it's been much easier as an adult than it was as a child, but I wouldn't trade those experiences for something better, because if I truly believe that, I know it's still going to be there. It's not going to lessen my time there. So that's kind of my thought on it,
I guess. Literally eternal, so what's the hurry?
Right, right.
Yeah. It's funny. We, people who are raised in the church, raised Christian, raised certain kinds of Christian, lots of kinds of Christian, were raised to fetishize martyrdom, to look at Jesus was willing to die. Why aren't you? Peter and Paul were willing to die. Why aren't you? This girl in Columbine, there's this story that we like to tell that the reason she died is because of Jesus. Well, do you have that kind of courage? And it's like this constant challenge of like, look how bad the early church had it. Why don't we have it that bad? Why aren't we being picked on? Well, it's because, you know, and you can take that question in a lot of directions, but like this idea that you must suffer, you must be willing to die, like that was a constant thing. And it's hard to square with like the massive privilege that accompanies being raised Christian in America.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is I feel like it was, and I appreciate my church growing up in so many ways. I don't think that it messed me up so much as it did others on this podcast, for instance. But there are things like that where it felt like we were to think that Christians have it really bad.
Yes.
And we don't, especially in America. Now, there are probably places in the world where that's true.
Yes.
Here, that is not the case. No matter how much we want it to be the case, Christians are fine in America.
Quite.
So, I don't know. It did feel like we were supposed to feel like dying was our ultimate glory.
Yeah. Which, like, man. If you weren't raised in this world and you're hearing this and you're thinking, wow, that's pretty insane. Yeah, we know.
And on that note, suicide was also a huge, huge fear. I would never consider myself like a suicidal person, but it constantly would cross my mind that I would not have eternal salvation if I tried to kill myself. Mm-hmm. And that's just bizarre. Especially now, I have lost two siblings, one by suicide. So my brain can't keep up with the fact that this is how we were taught to believe.
Yeah, yeah. The Catholic idea that, like, if the last thing you do is a sin, that, you know, that's it for your soul. Like, what a heavy idea, and what a thing to be confident about.
Right.
What a thing to tell people.
It's almost more of a fear tactic.
Yeah, and I mean, there are better ways to ensure people do not engage in self-harm than making up
scaring comfort. Them out of it, which isn't working anyway, because you're probably just making them more...
Yeah, now you're giving them more negative feelings.
Right.
Right? Yeah. Whew! Yeah, my answer for this would be, on the one hand, yes, like all good Christian youth, I yearned to be martyred, yearned for someone to come along and tell me I was such a great Christian that they had to shoot me. Which, yeah, that's a normal thing for a 9, 10, 11-year-old to want, sure. but at the same time, 100, the part in Buzzwole's question that would have tripped young me up if I was being completely honest with you is 100% sure I had my ticket to the dance. At no point ever in my entire adolescence was I 100% sure that I was saved.
I agree with that. I feel like I had to... It's just so weird, and I don't know where this comes from for me in particular. For you, I get it a little bit more. But this is probably just me in general, because I always felt like I was going to be in trouble. Always. So I would constantly have to make sure I was saved, and I probably on a daily basis asked to be saved in my prayers, which is insane. And I don't know why, for me in particular, other than... the people around me that were supposed to be taking care of me were not. So I felt like if I could be in trouble with them while doing everything right, I probably was in trouble with God too.
Mm-hmm. I was the same way. And I didn't even have to endure, you know, a lot of the things you did as a kid.
Yeah. It's a weird thing to wrestle with Christianity as a child.
I think it's too much for little people. That is my personal opinion. I think it's, there are versions of it, I think, that, you know, are kid friendly, which is like, you know, hey, this guy Jesus, he said some cool stuff about being nice to people, and you know, let's look at this specific thing about, like, there is a being who created the world, and this being is biased in favor of love and harmony and taking care of people and all that stuff. Like, that's cool and good. The idea of hell and salvation and you know, judgment, all this heavy stuff, deeply resent and despise how much of that we pour into little brains.
So that's that.
Time for a light question from Travis Miller. Where do you fall in the Calvinism versus Arminianism debate? So let's do this one pretty quickly. Calvinism, I feel like most people are familiar with, even if they don't know it's Calvinism. John Calvin, one of history's greatest assholes. Of course,
so you know where he stands.
He was a murderous tyrant. It's fine. It's fine that he formed the basis of, like, most, you know, most American European religion. That's fine. No big deal. Just literally, you know, had a guy burned at the stake for disagreeing about God's stuff. That's fine. We'll treat him, his opinions, like they matter. John Calvin, predestination. God created the universe knowing ahead of time who would go to hell. He created those people anyway. Cool. This is a really nice God. This is a great God. Awesome stuff. Free will's fake. Everything you do is automated. You're an automaton. You're a robot. You're here to either go to heaven or hell. Hope you gambled correctly. Hope you struck it rich and you don't have to go to hell. All that stuff. We're fallen from Eden. The Garden of Eden made everything bad and shameful and horrible and awful and everything. You know, you were born tainted and miserable and disgusting and nasty, even though you were created by God. But that's too bad because...
you're not one of the chosen few.
Adam and Eve did a sin, so therefore you were born just coated in nasty, gross tar. And maybe you'll be lucky enough to already be chosen to escape it, but, you know, probably not. once saved, always saved is the one idea that jumps out of Calvinism that actually makes people feel good. But, you know, obviously, like we just discussed in our last question,
did not make us feel good.
I don't think it took.
Well, I, to be fair, growing up, once saved, always saved, we knew that was a Baptist thing. That was not true. Like, you could fall out of God's good graces.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, we were taught that. I didn't have confidence, and here was the trap I always fell into. If you doubt your salvation, then were you ever once saved to begin with, right? Like, I ran my brain through that rat maze 1,000 times. If, like, I did the salvation, I've been baptized twice, I did the salvation thing, I'm saved, but I'm doubting it. So how could I have been once saved, always saved, if I'm not even sure if I was once saved? It's fun. It's awesome. It's awesome that we put this stuff in the brains of preteens. Jacobus Arminius is sort of the opponent of John Calvin historically. And, you know, his idea was that, yes, free will exists. You know, there is an all-knowing God who left some of history open-ended. You choose whether you... And again, this is still very Orthodox Christianity type stuff. So you choose to accept salvation, or, you know, we're still in the world in which heaven and hell and salvation and all that stuff is real. But people have a choice, have a chance, have minds that they apply on whether they're in or out. And salvation is conditional in this worldview. I would say if I were to come down with one, I would say yes, free will exists to a certain extent. God is omnipotent and all-knowing, but I do not take that to mean God literally chose everything. Like, when I play The Sims or I, you know, look at an ant farm, I am not choosing every single thing that any of these, you know, beings is doing. Like, you know, if you have a, you know, a view of the universe in which God pressed play and he's just fine with some things playing out, like, fine. Like, it is insane to me when people say everything happens for a reason, that type of thing. Some things just happen. It doesn't mean God is orchestrating every little tiny thing, because once you say that, you have to say that God orchestrated the horrible, indefensible things too. And I don't think anybody wants to say that. So, like, yes, free will. Duh, it exists. I don't know why we've argued about this for thousands of years. But John Calvin, oh, you scumbag, provided the perfect way out of his own theology, because what did he teach us? He taught us God chooses who goes to heaven. Well, what did John Calvin also admit? God loves everyone. Square those two things together. Who's going to heaven? Probably everyone God loves. John Calvin, universalist legend. Love it.
I bet he would love you saying that.
Well, when I get to wherever he is right now, I will be, all right? If that man made the cut, then I will, because I've never murdered anybody. So I'm going to spend a zillion years in heaven trying to find him. It'll be easy to find him because, like, everyone on Twitter who has an awful theology opinions, they have John Calvin's avatar. So I'm just going to look for those guys. And I'm going to say, hey, buddy, guess what? It turns out I was chosen just as much as you were. That's crazy. But if, you know, if hell is real and he's sent down there for being a murderous tyrant, then, like, I mean, I guess I'm probably going to... And again, I'll find him a zillion years from now. Just look for the black and white bearded Twitter avi guy and just say, like, joke's on you, pal. So, yeah, John Calvin was right about one thing. Andrew Klayma of the Lit Lit podcast, where they... They get drunk and read books, which is like, I mean, those are like the two best things to do. When you see the Bible or other elements of Christianity referenced in pop culture, do you get interested because it's a subject you're familiar with, or is it tough to enjoy because it's so easy for it to be handled poorly? I think a lot of things about this. I think when it's, if it's just the Bible, I don't want like just a literally by the book telling of the story.
If that's the case, it needs to be true to the Bible, I feel like.
So we've talked about it in our Noah episode, the Russell Crowe movie. It's a ridiculous over-the-top movie, and I love it because it doesn't contradict the Bible at all. It takes the Bible as a framework, and then it creates its heart out within that framework, and it gives you a story that you have never thought about before, gives you new themes, introduces new things, and read the story. Read the story and then watch the movie. Not a single thing that happens in there directly contradicts what's in the Bible. That's good. That's brilliant. The Last Temptation of Christ, which we've talked about on this show at some point, takes the gospel story of Jesus, changes some things, adds some things, but unearths this story of a tormented Messiah, tormented by having to be the Messiah, and also a human. So, like, taking the Bible and getting creative with it, I love it, right? It's like, what bothers me is taking, like, boring basic orthodoxy, taking boring basic by-the-book tellings, and just like, okay, this is the exact same as going to church.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to be entertained.
There's that.
That's how, I mean, I'm not going to judge it before seeing it, but if it looks boring, I'm probably not going to watch it.
And this is where VeggieTales comes in, because VeggieTales checks all the correct boxes.
Right, right.
It's going to be fun.
What was the other thing that we watched? The Donny Osmond thing.
Oh, yeah. Sure, if you add songs and stuff, yeah. Then that's probably creative enough.
Why can't I think of that?
The Technicolor Dreamcast.
Yes, thank you.
So we watch a lot of Donny Osmond musicals, so
I get them confused, I'm sorry.
Crossed up sometimes. I'm trying to think of other examples. Oh, like Jason Aaron, comic book artist. The Goddamned is his story of before the flood. It's a total spin on this idea of Noah as like God's anointed savior, because it's told from the perspective of Cain, who's been wandering the earth this entire time, cursed with being the first murderer. It also cursed with being unable to die. So in this comic, Cain is still alive all the way to the flood, and Cain is this, like, he's thrust into this role of, like, he's like this badass protector type, kind of a Punisher character, where, like, he's awesome, he's the most violent guy, he can't die. He's kind of a Wolverine. It's Cain is Wolverine, who's around until the flood, basically, and Noah is this, like, wild-eyed cult leader. So, like, that's a spin. There is Judas, the comic. I think we've talked about it. Jeff Loveness, the story of Judas in hell. And he's down there as Jesus goes down during Jesus's 3 days in hell, if you subscribe to that idea. And Judas is down there, and Judas confronts Jesus. Did you know I was going to betray you? Did you know I was going to end up down here? If you had just left me alone, if you had never invited me to join your band of 12, I would have never betrayed you, and I wouldn't be down here. And Jesus has to admit, yes, it was the story. It was the part of the story. It was the plan. And we see this, you know, Jesus is wrestling with the idea of being Jesus, and Jesus is wrestling with Judas being Judas. And I haven't really spoiled it because there's a lot of other stuff in there. But yes, take the basic framework and get creative with it. Like, I'm fine if it ends up stupid or bad. That's better than boring.
Yeah, it's true. Agreed. I watch a lot of stupid movies.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And finally, from Ashley, how's the book coming?
It's coming great. I'm working on a lot of cool things.
I was going to ask and, for your book.
And I'm doing a really good job.
We have talked about doing, if you've made it this far into the podcast, then I think we can give away this idea. We have talked about doing our own like children's book.
Version of the Bible that tells the truth?
Well, like, yeah, it takes like almost like an animated, almost like a illustrated children's version of this podcast. We're like, hey, here's this wacky fun story.
Yeah.
And then... Hey, kids, you're taught hell is real. Let's look in the Bible where it says that, you know, and like, oh, it's kind of...
or
not as definitive as your scary pastor says, or like, hey kids, your pastor said being gay is wrong, you know, and like doing like a kid friendly version of our Leviticus episode, you know.
Yeah, well, even like taking a Bible story like Noah's Ark and telling it for what it is. It doesn't mean that it has to be like pushing people away from the Bible,
right?
But it should be in a way that can make kids relate more, like we're learning to now.
Yeah.
Not in just a way that's like sunshiny rainbows and look how pretty the rainbows are and that's all we have.
Yeah. Yeah. It like, God feels bad.
Yeah.
God feels bad. That's remorse, the most important thing.
Remorse is a good lesson.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Like, you know, anyone can mess up. Anyone can fail. These are good lessons for kids. These are good things for kids to hear. So yeah, we've talked about doing that. I am also writing a coming-of-age ex-evangelical novel. I've had a few people read a first draft of it, and feedback was positive. Working on some big things right now. Working toward, you could call it a second draft. It's also kind of a second thousandth draft. I just tinker with it constantly, but discarding a lot of like secondary plot lines and stuff. Like I just sort of packed everything into it. It's the story of 4 years of high school. These kids who are wrestling with being with trying to be normal kids, with trying to be Christians, with a lot of the stuff we've talked about on this episode. Are we saved? How much does the political stuff matter? Is there only one good political party? Is there one perfect set of carefully orchestrated beliefs that we have to subscribe to, or can we pick and choose? What happens if you think hell is literal? What are the only rational things you can do if you think hell is literal? Well, you'd probably wave a gun around in order to scare people out of hell, wouldn't you? So there's a lot of gun waving. And these kids are also wrestling with being very close to the dynasty layer of a church, a vaguely regionalized, vaguely denominationed church. One of our characters is the pastor's niece. One is a pastor's son. One is the brother of a guy who gets higher up in that world. So these kids who are wrestling with all this stuff are also front and center in this show. It's set around the time of 9/11 and Lord of the Rings is our setting. and I found a lot of things to say about both of those. So, yeah, I want youth group nostalgia. I want to be clear that, like, hey, there was a lot of good and heart and light and warmth to take from this world. And there are a lot of us who would not be humans if we hadn't gone through youth group. And there's a lot of darkness and pain and fear and shame.
I think it's a great book for people who did not grow up in that world to kind of have an insider's perspective. That's also a bit lighthearted. And it's also interesting for someone who did grow up in that world.
So, yeah, I am interested after another round of reader feedback in talking to book agent, book publisher types. So if anyone out there happens to know any of those folks that you might be interested in putting me in touch with, certainly interested. The readership is probably going to be young adult. That is, I mean, the characters are, main characters are all teenagers. But I think it would have appeal to folks who grew up in the world and then either left it or thought about leaving it or left it and came back, or probably not so much people who are just think everything is awesome within a fun deep world. Those folks probably
wouldn't. But perhaps it will provide them a new perspective. Probably not.
You know, they could use one, and I say that not even sarcastically or snarkily, because, like, people are leaving your churches, right? Like, the ex-evangelical movement is, like, so big that people know what it means. Like, it's not just a Twitter thing. Like, it's an actual thing that, like, the head of the Southern Baptist Convention had to write a whole thing about it on his way out. That, like, yeah, this is happening. Your membership is plummeting. Your whole house of cards is crashing. You're going to be left with nothing but the crazy people who stormed the Capitol. Why? Well, I have some thoughts. So, I mean, I don't know, man. I wanted to get to a place where it feels completely honest and good and fair to every character in it. I want to get to a place where even the antagonists have rational purpose, and a lot of their purpose is probably going to stem from the theology. If hell is real, then everything is justified. That is working titles I've thrown around a few: youth group, church kids. A couple I'm thinking of a lot right now would be Save Yourself from Hell. It's from Event Horizon, the horror movie. It's sampled by Zayo, the Christian metalcore band, in their album about not really about Jesus will save you from hell. It's more about like going to hell. But like I've found a lot of ways to read that those four words, save yourself from hell. I love the terrible theology of it. I love the I love, you know, there's like a defiance of it. There's a desperation to it. There's a lot of ways to say it. Another one that I've thought of, a very similar version of that would be hell is only a word. Again, from the exact same source, Event Horizon.
That was one of the first movies that we watched together, by the way. Like he's been a long-time fan of Event Horizon.
Well, and it's going back and really thinking about it that I've realized why it both freaked me out so much and why I was so drawn to it. It's a corny space horror movie, you know, the most over-the-top violence imaginable. Like, you know, it's a pretty good horror movie. It could have been a whole lot better, but like the way it handles humanity versus damnation and the characters in this movie, what do? They run toward damnation to save people, and they do it over and over. And the damnation in this movie is so unreasonable and unfair, and people are set up to fail. And if those are the rules of the universe, and if that is how your religion works, then your religion is a horror movie. So yeah, like it's funny. Like I do remember that when you came around, it was like, look at this movie my friends liked in high school. But like going back and thinking about why did we like this movie so much?
Yeah, this gives me a whole lot more perspective now, knowing why he likes this movie versus then. Which I mean, I just like to be entertained. It was entertaining,
yes.
So I was fine with it. But yeah.
So this has been a lighthearted episode of the Vacation Bible School podcast.
Yeah, question and answer time is usually more fun than this.
We talked about animals. That was
fun. Yeah, we did.
We talked about going to Toronto.
Yeah.
And frolicking
there are fun
to
moments.
The Red Hot Chili Peppers. Mm-hmm. So if you have any interest in connecting more with this podcast, we got Twitter account, VBS podcast, Instagram account, same handle. There's a Patreon with some stuff on it. We, as of this recording, are attempting to fire up a monthly book club on our Zoom chat. We'll see if it'll stay on Zoom. Might move over to the Discord. Who knows? So yeah, if you would like to get involved with that, our Patreon Discord will be the best way for now to stay in touch. I plan to send out messages through the Patreon page, and we have a VBS room in our Discord there that we're pretty much always chatting about this stuff. But yeah, we will be back on course next time with the Book of Numbers, which again has espionage and talking animals. What more could you want? But yeah, that's it. That's it for this episode of VBS.
Goodbye.